two rules
to remember if you want to have a good time.
Rules. No rules.
Rule number one.
Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Rule number two.
You're a dragon. Be a dragon.
This week on Double Dragon, Steve and I cover The King of the Narrow Sea, and then medievalist Kavita Mudon Finn answers a question about sex and perceptions of sex in the pre-modern period. So you're not going to want to miss that. And folks, I would love it if you would leave us an iTunes review on Apple iTunes. Rate, subscribe. It would help us out immensely. Okay, without further ado, here is San Francisco Punchline's own stand-up comic, Steve Osborne. Steve, I can't figure out whether Daemon Targaryen is a genius or if he's a complete fool at the end of this episode.
Yeah, it's like we want our villains to be masterminds.
He does a little bit. There's a tiny mastermind in there, but you got to dig around for it in a lot of foolishness to find the mastermind part of it.
Well, sometimes it feels like he's like an accidental mastermind.
Right.
And it's like so many things like, is he lying because it's part of the grander scheme? Is he playing one person against the other, or is he just completely improvising?
Yeah, that's a good question. Is he improvising as he goes? Or does he have this whole scheme in mind? I mean, there's this one scene where he pulls her hat off to reveal her hair that will make her recognizable,
right,
among the common folk. And I don't know why he does that unless it is to expose her. Like he's gotten her vulnerable, and now he's going to play the perception game and weaken her with the perception game, and maybe that was his whole plan all along. Or was it just sort of like, I think I'll do this now, and he pulls off her and he doesn't think about the consequences,
right? Or it's like he's got maybe like a destructive side, like This would be unpredictable, and it would completely change the dynamic of what we're doing. But without like thought as to now what, as opposed to just like it's just sort of bringing a touch of chaos into everything he does.
Right. I think that the first time I watched this, I thought, oh, he's a genius. This is going to totally expose her, and this is going to weaken the king, and now she's not going to be able to be queen because now people don't like her even more, and he knows exactly what he's doing. And the second time I watched it, I thought, he's got no clue what's going to happen next.
Right.
So keep my eyes on him. I'm continuing to be fascinated with him. I don't know how to read him yet.
I'm the same way. And I think there's just so much of that happens in this episode where it just seems kind of chaotic, and I don't know, like maybe he's lying, oh, but he's lying because he's got a bigger plan. It's like, or is he lying and not wise enough to realize that maybe his lie has been undercut elsewhere? Like he's not really in control, but like. But also, if his end goal, it feels almost like this is just a brotherly spat that has just escalated over the years because their station has changed.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, so much of this really does feel like it's just these guys.
This is all about
doing their best.
Yeah. This was sort of this is a very dysfunctional family for a number of reasons. And we got to see it all on display this episode.
Yeah.
I was really impressed with this episode. But we'll get to that. Okay, I've identified five storylines. And Rhaenyra is attached to almost all of these. The first storyline I call The Princess and the Penis.
Ooh.
Yes. Rhaenyra impatiently listens to potential suitors and leaves when the gathering turns violent. On her way back to King's Landing, her ship has a fender bender with a dragon. By the way, fantastic. A ship and a dragon having a fender bender. This is sort of... this is a perfect, perfect scene.
Well, for you, you got ships and dragons?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. It was like... the way that Rhaenyra looks at the Street of Silk, that was sort of me watching this ship get buzzed by the dragon.
You would have been susceptible to almost anything at this point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Take off all the hats you want. I'm going to let loose. Having spurned every suitor, she worries that her father will be angry. She seeks out Daemon, and they discuss marriage, childbirth, life, and death. Rhaenyra claims that she would prefer solitude to marriage. The night she's invited out to a fleshy carnival with Daemon, she sneaks out, sees a comedy, and a variety of tattoos. He tells her that sex can be pleasurable even for the woman, and kisses her. After another episode of ED, he ditches her. She returns to the keep and seduces Sir Criston. So we've talked a little bit about Daemon. I think that probably we need to talk a little bit about sort of his motives here. I think one way you could read this is that he just wants to show her a good time. I think he sees himself in her, and he might be a little bit hot for her. I don't know if he means to politically undermine her at first. I mean, I guess that's possible. It's possible that that was his plan all along. I'm going to do damage to my brother and his daughter.
That's the thing. I mean, this is what I think is probably one of the most fascinating parts of this. And I could also see this being something that might frustrate some other viewers. I think that what they've done here, they've complicated things by leaving so much out. Because we don't know exactly what Daemon... We have an idea what Daemon's motivations are, mm-hmm. but we don't also know if he's just petulant. Like, going back to what you were saying before, like, is this a big plan? Like, so, yeah, is he attracted to Rhaenyra? Or is he being politically motivated knowing that she is attracted to him, and so therefore he has the upper hand, and he knows he can complicate her, her stake to the throne by complicating their relationship, right. Or is he truly just sort of like, no, I really like Rhaenyra. I see a lot in myself in her, and then they have a good time, but then he, you know, his instincts to undermine kick in, and he takes the hat off, and then there's the question of, okay, is he seducing her? Or is he being seduced? Was it ED? Was it a change of heart? Is it a grand plan where he brings her to a certain point? Yeah. And then, so all of those, because we don't know what those motivations are, it's very, very hard to, we just feel like we're grasping at the wind here in some cases. Yeah. And I can see that in some ways I find it fascinating. Other times I'm just like, I'm not saying I get taken out, but there are moments where I'm like, well, I don't know what I'm watching. You know, I don't know. You know, and in a way that's fun. In a way, I think that is a good storytelling, because mm-hmm. I'm having a hard time charting the next move, which means that I'm sort of set up to be surprised no matter what.
Yeah, in Game of Thrones, it was sort of fun to watch Littlefinger sow seeds of chaos, right? Because you kind of knew his motives. It was like, I you know what I think I'm going to do? I think I'm going to sow as many seeds of chaos in the realm as possible. See the whole thing destabilize. See the thing crumble. And then I will advance. Right? That was sort of his motives. And then, of course, he had this little thing like, does he love Kat? Does he not love Kat? What's he do with Sansa? But you kind of understood his motivations. To a certain extent. And so you can kind of have fun to see what he's trying to do to achieve his ends.
Well, in Littlefinger, like, the purpose he served in the fiction also served for the audience, right? Because, like, they did a wonderful thing with this character where they created somebody who is constantly one step ahead and kind of tricking everybody, and nobody understands his true motivations. And as the audience, we were the same way. Because we're like, well, I don't know if is he motivated by love or political gain, or is it both? Is he one of these guys that is he like the Golden State Warriors? Is he developing the young talent and seeking to win a championship this year? Can he pull both off?
Yeah. Yeah. Or is one of it just a lie? Is it just a lie? And that right. was, that's what you kind of present to the world. But really, the other thing is what you want. I think that like at one point in this episode, Viserys says, Daemon and Rhaenyra both have the blood of the dragon. And that makes them chaotic and restless. So it's almost like we enjoyed watching Littlefinger because he was sowing seeds of chaos. Daemon Targaryen is chaos. He's like a chaos tornado wherever he goes. And sometimes it's fun to be the chaos tornado. And sometimes it's like, well, I guess I'm here now. What am I going to do now that I'm here? I didn't think ahead. I don't know. He could be a genius, though. It's just an odd character. I continue to be most fascinated with where his chaos tornado will land next.
Yeah, and it's almost like that is his superpower, right? Like, impetuous, yet able to then quickly adapt to the new scenario he just created.
Sure. Right. Yeah. That's a good way to say it. I love this first scene with Lord Bracken, and you know, it's the little kid who kind of comes to be her suitor. I watched that scene like 4 or 5 times. And I don't know why it was so exciting to me. I think it could have to do with this director that they brought on. Her name is Claire Kilner, and she was talking in the behind the scenes part of it. She was saying that I really wanted to show everything from a woman's perspective, and she was specifically talking about the sex scenes, like how would Rhaenyra be experiencing the sex scene, and then she, of course, Allison, you get to see her face during the sex scene with the king. But I think that this first scene, this fight scene, is very much shot with that in mind as well. Like, what would the woman in the room witness of this fight? Because what happens is you kind of see Rhaenyra really bored and then kind of shocked and then kind of bored again and a little bit amused. And she decides, I'm hungry, I'm leaving. So all these suitors are kind of like a afterthought to her, because she doesn't really want to marry any of them, right?
Right.
So this is all about her experience of the moment. And then when you see her walk away, the fighting still goes on. And I think that another direction would be like, put the camera where the action is. We want to see this fight unfold. But what Kilner does is she says, no, keep the camera on her face. And she'll turn around and see some of the violence. But what's important is her experience of it. I thought it was a masterfully shot scene, and I was shocked. I was like, I can't believe the little guy beat the big guy. You know, it's sort of like this Game of Thrones moment where it's like, what world am I watching? This is total chaos. And, you know, you think about it a little bit better. You think, oh, well, the little guy's got this sword that's 3 feet long, and the other one's got a dagger, so...
Yeah, but that's and you know, more to your point too, it's like that's not the issue here. Battles happen, you know, people are like, there's so much vying for position, and at this moment she has the position.
Yeah,
I mean, even though she's, quote, you know, going to be married off, and so it feels like she has no agency, she snatches agency back. You know, she sits and she kind of makes them go through the motions.
Right, she's going to hold on to her agency for as long as she possibly can.
Becomes a bit of a you know, a role reversal for many in many ways, right? Like, so here's all these men that are lining up to prove their worth, and she sort of dismisses. She's interested. She plays with them, and then she's like, "I'm out. I'm getting snacks," and then they keep on battling, because they're so focused on everything else, and then also there's just the nature of a man, even at a young age, they'll just fight to the death, right? I mean, it's just it's sort of this violence that they're sort of prone to, and then she, and you know, and the like you said, the focus on her it's actually it's where the power is, right? The camera goes to where the power is, and that's and it is ironic because it is something that she doesn't want to have to do because she feels like it's an obligation, but she flips it, right? Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that's different about her than Damon is that he's the other, right? I mean, he's going to be the one to fight. He's going to, you know, all right, I'm going to go and fight the crab feeder. I'll do all this other stuff. And there doesn't seem to be like there's calculation in the moment, but not long term, where she, even despite her age, feels like she has a little bit more of an idea of what the bigger picture is and what maybe some consequences are.
And I think that there's this sense with Damon that he knows that life is fleeting. He knows that the chaos is just part of it. And, at one point he says to her, yeah, you know, it's a tragic world, but if you live it in fear, you're going to miss the best parts of it. And he sort of resolved to live life hot and fast. And if it results in the crab feeder putting his hammer through my skull, then that's how I go out. And she's just unwilling because there's no glory in the birthing bed. She's like, no, I'm not going out like my mom went out. I'm not going to live like that. But she does want some of that like hot and fast life that her uncle has. So it really sort of is her chafing over sort of the gender assignment of this.
Right, and just think of it from her perspective too. She's like, my job is to create someone that can go and live the life I want to live.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a great. I think it's a great view of, and I love how she's juxtaposed with Allison this episode. But we'll get there. I for some reason I'm just totally fascinated by this fight between the Blackwoods and the Brackens, where it, you know, in this world that rivalry is like as old as like as sin. It's like
right.
These guys have hated each other forever. But what got me, I think, this kid is called a Craven, and that's it. It's on, right? It's going down. This is right. A world where if you say the magic word, there's going to be blood. It's fascinating to me in that there's so many things about the show that's like, oh, it's just like the modern world. And then you get reminded like, no, this is unlike anything you've experienced. This kid who looks, what, 12 years old? I don't know. Yeah. He has not gone through puberty yet. He gets called a Craven, and now it's like, now I have to go to battle with this grown man. And what is a world where you say the right word and now you're going to see a grown man fight a 12-year-old boy to death with big knives? It's goofy.
Yeah.
It's a goofy scene. It's a very Game of Thrones scene. I really liked it.
It's like when Marty McFly gets called a chicken. Uh-oh, it's on.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I love the scene. And then it was a little surprising. It's like, oh, all right, that didn't end the way I thought it was going to end. And we're off to the next thing. We're off
right.
to seeing a dragon have a fender bender with a boat. You know, it's like, it's a great beginning of an episode.
Yeah, and so let's go back to Damon and Rhaenyra. Now, your synopsis suggested that it was an ED-related aborted mission.
Yeah, that's how I read it.
I
think that's how I read it the first time because I was so fascinated by how his coupling ended with Masaria in episode one.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, this is interesting. This guy has a problem, and it's an interesting problem for this guy to have. I'm going to see how this plays out. And so when we get to the scene of, you know, they're in the bowels of the pleasure den and he's totally into it. And then all of a sudden he can't perform. That is how I read it. And well, let me hear from you first before I go where I'm going to go.
Well, seeing that, and that's, I think how I read it later, like looking back on it, because my initial thought was, again, I think I was giving him credit for,
not having sex with his niece.
Well,
Because you'd like to, yeah, really, you know, you'd like to give someone the benefit of the doubt when it comes to that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, all right, I've given you this is a C minus for morality. No, I,
what does it say about this show that was not even on your mind? That you were going to give him credit for? Yeah.
Well, I was going to give him credit for being devious. Right. That, like, maybe he was intentionally bringing her to this point where now he's, like, so it was a power move, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
It was bring you to a point of seduction, and then I'm going to end it abruptly, which that would be the, like, similar to sort of like that'd be like the parallel that you would have with Rhaenyra earlier, where she's like sort of toying with the men and then moves on, right? Like that's how I initially read it, was like, okay, so this is his version of this story where he's now taking a much more powerful position. But then to read it later, especially as we just talked about how he seems to adapt to his own chaos,
mm-hmm.
That's actually a really interesting element to his character, because here's another example where he may have accidentally made a power move.
Sure, sure.
Because his body betrays him.
That's funny.
Now he has a new set of, and he's like, well, now there's a new path I'm going to go on.
That's fantastic, yeah.
And I think that makes it even more intriguing, right? Is that he's this, you know, like, again, go back to the idea of Damon the accidental mastermind.
Right, 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 right. So I will say this, and I don't like to appeal to this kind of stuff, but in the after the or inside the episode conversation afterwards,
mm-hmm.
I think it's Ryan Condal or one of the people interviewed said, yeah, then he has ED and he can't complete the act. And he actually says, because he feels like in order for him to enjoy the experience, he has to be in total control. And she kind of like starts, you know, taking control sexually, and he doesn't know what to do with that. So the writer might have an intent for the character, but by the time it gets to the director's kind of in control. Maybe Kilner decided to do something different with the scene, or maybe Matt Smith decided he was going to bring something else to the performance. And then, of course, I'm involved, too, as a watcher. And so if it's open to interpretation, at that point, the experience is mine as a viewer to decide or not decide, you know, based on the conversations that I'm having. So I don't necessarily just want to, like, pull out the authorial intent card. I do think it is one, you know, it's one voice in the conversation that's worth listening to.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I think is important, too. I mean, in my, you know, myriad literature classes, and, you know, you start getting into various interpretations. And, you know, one of the things that you're taught early on is that authorial intent is, like, maybe 10% of the battle, right? I mean,
right.
Because I don't necessarily like to be... Because one of the things that I enjoy about shows like this is wrestling with some of the ambiguities and then either being surprised later or just that to me, this it's all part. It's like a good meal that also is presented well on the plate, right? Like it's taste is part of it, but the experience is really what you're going for. And so when someone says, this is what happened and this is what I intended. And like, and to your point, it's like, yeah, but it's getting translated now through many different lenses, right? I mean, like you said, there's a director, there's an actor, there's editors, there's once you add music, once you, all the different things that you go through, and then you say, okay, and now me watching it, now the context of my viewing experience, things that I'm grabbing onto or paying attention to, maybe a little closer, things I'm reading a little closer, things maybe I'm not catching. That's all part of it. And that's...
I really like the culinary metaphor here. I think it's great. I think it's sort of like... So let's say you've got a chef that's really into the culinary arts. So the intention of the chef was to do something, and maybe the chef knows a lot more about the meal than the person who ate it. But the chef didn't experience the meal like the person who ate the meal.
Right.
And I think it's a great metaphor for sort of the relationship between the creator and the consumer.
Yeah, and I think with the, you know, and it's fine when an author, you know, author says this is what was supposed to happen. It's like, yeah, and I believe it. Like, yeah, right. I believe that ED played a role. But I think that the point, you know, that as we start going further, it's like, but why and how? Like, was it just as simple as, oops, I got to this point and I couldn't seal the deal? Or is it, no, I really thought I was going to seal the deal and now I'm surprised by it. So now I have a different reaction to it. So it sets it sets things going, right? I mean, there's a lot of ways that and, you know, like, there's just a lot that could go on there, right? Like I said, if it was a power dynamic shift and that caused him to shut down, that's one thing. If it's just, oh, here we go again.
Okay. And I think, I mean, just to put all my cards on the table, I read it as ED for the very, before I heard the interview. And so when I heard the author say, yeah, that was what we were going for, I felt this tiny bit of vindication. Like, yeah, I read it right. It's my view. My view is the right view. Which is totally unfair. But I will say this. Later on, Daemon is being questioned. And, Viserys basically says, you defiled my daughter. And what does he say? He doesn't say, no, man, I couldn't perform. He says, what does it matter? You know, look at what we did when we were that age. And it's almost like, is it more embarrassing to say that he couldn't perform? I mean, I'm guessing that in the pre-modern world, this is sort of tantamount to effeminizing yourself.
Right.
Maybe he would prefer to be, you know, to be thought of sort of as the bad boy tornado who you can't trust than the guy who can't perform in the bedroom.
Well, and it does suggest, again, I think the brotherly dynamic is such an interesting one, is that they... You know, I don't know if what your experience is with your siblings, but I've seen this with my wife's siblings, is when they all get together, regardless of how much older they've gotten and life experience has changed, every time they get together, they sort of
they involuntarily fall back into their immature
into role. Their roles. Yeah, their roles. Everybody, you know, the eldest is the eldest and has a certain amount of expectations on how they're treated, and the youngest is, you know, on and on it goes, right? And it just I see that often with almost any sibling. So here you have these, you know, these two siblings that are arguably, you know, two of the most powerful men in the realm, and when they get together, it just sort of falls back into old, you know, we've already saw they had their Smothers Brothers moment in the garden. I mean,
that was pretty good. I mean, look, Viserys, the range on Viserys is just magnificent. A lot of the actors got to do a lot of range this episode.
Yeah.
All right. Next storyline. This is Rhaenyra part two. Viserys has problems. The king receives his brother who has conquered the Stepstones. Daemon kneels and hands over his arts and crafts crown. The two brothers laugh over old times in the Godswood. Later on, the king learns that Corlys has become a problem in the Stepstones. Moreover, the Sea Snake is planning a marriage alliance with Braavos. After a gross bath and even grosser sex, he's told about Daemon and his daughter in a pleasure house. The king summons Daemon, he interrogates him, kicks him, puts a knife to his throat, and refuses Daemon's request to marry Rhaenyra. Later on, he reminds his daughter about Targaryen prophecy and tells her that her duties are more important than her desires. He commands her to marry Laenor. Later that night, Master Melos shows up to deliver moon tea. Okay, so Daemon says something to Viserys. He says, when I gave up my crown, you said I could have anything. Do you remember that conversation happening? I don't remember that conversation happening.
I don't either. And it did kind of take me, not out, but like a moment. I was just like, because I, what I don't like is when I'm because like, there's so much to keep track of.
Yeah.
And when you're like, well, is this something that was like, this is a narrative way to be like, oh, this conversation happened, don't worry about it. You know? Or then I'm like, oh, wait, did I miss something? Uh-huh. And when did I miss it?
Right. And I think it was, it must have happened off screen. Or maybe it happened when like they were embracing in front of the throne. It's all very interesting to me. Like, what, if you're Viserys, why would you say such a thing?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not exactly sure, but I mean, there is. I mean, ultimately, the scene matters because there's a bend the knee moment, right? I mean, it's it's significant, and then it's a significant way to just. And it was a very casual when everything was said and done. Like, hey, got a new haircut, bend in the knee. Things are different now. Right. Getting ready for the job interview.
Yes. Okay. So Vasir, if Vasir said that, and I guess I'm supposed to think that he did, it's sort of further indication that he's blinded by love. Like he's sort of blind. He was blinded by love for Rhaenyra in sort of allowing her to make her own marriage choice. When everyone around her is saying, "You're the king, just marry her off. She doesn't have a choice in it." It's like, no, I want her to be happy. I'm going to do something to make her happy.
And in this case, I want her to be happy the way that I chose to be happy, which I think is also fascinating. I mean, that still is this undercurrent of selfishness, really, for him. And he's like, it's almost like he can justify his own his own selfishness by then passing it down.
Yeah, in this case, he wants so desperately to make up with his brother. And I honestly do believe that he loves his little brother. It's just that he can't figure out what the hell he's going to do next. And he's just...
I think they both love each other, but I don't think either one has any respect for each other.
Okay, that's a good point. That's a good point. And so if that's the case, why would you promise this to your tornado brother? I don't see what he can gain in this.
Because I think too, in the same way that we talk about Daemon's unpredictability, there's a certain amount of that with Viserys too. It's just maybe a little more calm, and he's in it, and he does it in a way that doesn't seem as, I mean, like he named Rhaenyra his heir, and then he was going to waver on that, and then when he gets pushed about that, he's like, well, no, I need to make it look like my plan was my plan the whole time, and so he's doing it in a way that, like, I think Daemon's moves are much more bombastic, but his reaction time is maybe a little more graceful. Whereas Viserys is like this long, kind of drawn out, clumsy way of dealing with things, and then he reacts, but not like with any intentionality, almost like he's reacting. Reacting against his own ego or alongside it in some way. It's an interesting dynamic because they're not as dissimilar as it would appear.
Yeah, Viserys kind of presents as someone who used to know how to have fun, but it's been a long time since he was not king. You know, he's been king for a while now, and you don't get to have, I mean, unless you're Robert Baratheon, I guess.
Yeah.
The king doesn't get to have fun.
Viserys doesn't want to be king, and Daemon thinks he wants to be king. And it's like, if you were to flop their roles, man, I think it would be very similar. You know, I mean, Daemon probably would make a little more impetuous decisions and whatnot, but I think that they would both be dissatisfied.
Yeah, that's a good question. Would Daemon be a horrible king, or would Daemon sort of, is he kind of like the dog that can finally catch the bus? You know, he doesn't know what he wants. He's striving for it, but if he actually got it, he wouldn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, I think so, and I think I'm looking at the brotherly rivalry too, which is like, okay, look, you had everything. You may be this. Mom even liked you better, as far as I'm concerned. But I'm king, and I'm gonna prove that I'm the better choice for king. Whether I want to be king or not, I'm just holding on to it. I don't even want this toy, but I know you want this toy. So this is now my favorite toy. If anybody asks, I don't have to share this toy. I mean, it sometimes feels like that's what it boils down to with these two. And I think that makes it such a more intriguing storyline, because it's such a base way to look.
Oh man, these guys are—they're like reverting back to when they were like, you know, 12 and 6 or whatever the age difference there. But there's a real sort of sense of immaturity baked into their relationship.
Yeah, I mean, even like I said, when Daemon is confronted about Sully and Rhaenyra, he's like, maybe, you know, like there's just a certain element of. Like it serves, it doesn't serve him well to be coy in the if he's being strategic. But yeah, if you're not really interested in strategy at that point, if you're really just interested in, and like, look, I'm sowing seeds of chaos that may end up yielding me this thing that you want only because you're keeping it from me.
Right. Yeah, there's a few characters in this story that are kind of attracted to Damon because he is a tornado. It's like you're fascinated with it because that's where the action is. And then you get caught up in it and you realize, oh man, there's consequences and he's willing to live with them. And I don't know if I'm willing to live with these. And I think Viserys and Rhaenyra are both caught up into his tornado in different ways. Of course, Viserys kind of has the long view. And you kind of get to see that in this episode, that he's you know, it's my job to have the long view. And it's not, you know, I'm not going to act like a teenager here. And how can you fault her for acting like a teenager?
And he does have the advantage of, you know, like he's grown up with Damon. So there's even as unpredictable as maybe Damon can be, Viserys is at least used to it.
Well, and there is also the oldest brother in this world, right? The oldest brother, there's expectations on that guy's shoulders that the second son wishes he had, and the older brother kind of like regrets that he has.
Right.
This is like this dynamic, like, okay, well, you're going to have to be the lord of this great house, and so we need you to grow up a little bit faster. And the second son is sort of like less important, but guess what? The second son gets to have a little bit more fun than you. And I think that there's always sort of this, I think I'd do better in your role.
Yeah.
There was one other thing I want to talk about with this storyline. He tells her at one point, Viserys is talking with Rhaenyra, and he says, the truth isn't important, only perception.
Right.
And I think it's a really important Game of Thrones line. It's like, what is the truth? The truth is she did not have sex with her uncle, right? That's the truth of the matter. Now, she spins it in, you know, toward falsehood when she's talking with Alicent. But the truth of the matter, factually speaking, she did not have sex with her uncle. And the king kind of tells her, it doesn't matter. That part doesn't matter. It's how it looks to everyone else. And that's what you have to learn if you're going to rule.
Yeah.
And I think that Damon also tries to teach her a similar lesson when they're watching the mummers play or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Right, their opinions don't matter, and Damon's like laughing at her, saying, "They kind of do matter if you want to rule."
Right, and if you look like you don't have control of your own situations, then you don't look like you have control of the kingdom. And you know, and in this case, it was like, just don't, you know, you put yourself in a situation where even if it's just a lie and gossip, there's enough smoke. And we shouldn't even be having to go around and do damage control when in this position.
Yeah. If you're trying to explain that there was no fire, there was only smoke, you've lost the perception battle. Right.
Right.
So, man. Okay. This next storyline is called Alicent's Descent. The princess and the queen find common ground in their sense of powerlessness. Alicent tries to find the bright side of politically arranged marriages. The queen can only thinly veil her profound unhappiness. Rhaenyra consoles her and apologizes. That night, Alicent bounces her baby like a frightened babysitter. At an ungodly hour, she is summoned to the king's chambers. The next day, she overhears gossip about Rhaenyra, and confronts her in the Godswood. The princess swears upon her dead mother that she did not couple with her uncle. Alicent discusses Rhaenyra with the king and suggests that Damon is lying. Alicent is kind of representing the traditional upstanding wife in this episode. You know, she's kind of, she plays by the rules. She plays by all of the rules, all the gender rules, and she's profoundly unhappy in the process.
Right. Yeah. And it's, and this is, I mean, she's the queen.
Yeah. You got the boon. You got what everyone thinks that they want, right? You're the most powerful woman in the kingdom, right? Quote unquote. Right. So,
right. And yet you have to just just lie there and take it. That's just essentially, you know, what it means, right? And
episode one, I think you gave Viserys the name King Scabby Patty.
Yeah.
This was like the, you know, this is sort of the pinnacle of King Scabby Patty in this episode.
Yeah. Real unappetizing. But she sort of portrays this, a voice of reason, but as this goes on, and we kind of know it already from her father, but as the episode progresses, it's like you get a real feeling for Alicent in the sense that she is really just a prop.
Yeah,
in
right.
so many ways.
Yeah, and her father used her as a tool, and now she's just the king's prop, right?
Right, and the king, you know, for all of his speeches to his daughter about like almost how he's noble for having chosen a life of happiness as opposed to what is best maybe for the political side of things. Well, that's fine, but how's she doing in this? How's Alicent doing in this? I mean, this is, even in this, you know, it's like the consequences of what we choose, whether, you know, we're in leadership or not, I mean, it has ramifications, right? And so like he's made this choice to be happy, but it shows that not only has he done this relationship that may have not been the best political move, so it may not be the best for the realm, it's not even best for his immediate circle, right? You know, in just like it shows how incredibly selfish this move was. He doesn't have, like, the relationship that he had with his you know, previous wife was, there seemed to be a mutual affection.
That's right. And respect. You know, it really did present as sort of like, that's the rare jewel that you almost never find in Game of Thrones, a marriage that actually found love. And then of course he chooses the baby over the wife in this.
Right.
Okay, so Alicent is interesting to me because at the beginning of the episode, she's kind of commiserating with Rhaenyra, like, aren't we both in the same situation? Like we were at odds. We should hold to each other like ships in a storm. Like, you know, I guess that metaphor doesn't work. Ships don't hold each other in storms. Can we talk about the ships more? I just want to talk about the ships.
I wish ships had arms.
But they should cling to each other like they are in a storm. And they...
Like taxi cabs.
Like bicycles. We're going to find it. At some point, we're going to find the metaphor that works here. they should hold on to each other. They both are, in a sense, like they are living different lives, but they can see the parallels enough that they realize we should be friends because we have this in common. And it only takes one night for Alicent to realize, what are you doing out at night? Like, I've been playing by the rules. This is miserable. I thought that we as women decided we were going to play by the rules and be miserable. That's the life of women. Right? And she's right. And so it's sort of like, Rhaenyra,
we had a pact.
We had a pact. That's right. So what are you griping about? You're out with your uncle at the hour, you know, the hour of the owl. How could you even allow yourself to be put in a situation where your reputation is besmirched? At the start of this episode, you really see that they have a lot in common. And at the end of the episode, you really see that they're living much different lives.
The hour of the owl is a phrase I need to use more.
Is that the only hour that you can couple?
Yeah. What is the Westeros version of a nooner?
I really like the phrase coupling. Because they have other words, but that's a very old-timey phrase I think we should bring back.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, my wife's giving me a hard time because, like, I'm kind of, like, you know, reacting to certain things in the show as it's happening. And I use the phrase more than once. Like, oh, what happens if Rhaenyra's with child? And she's like, with child?
Oh, goodness. Well, yeah, and that's something that the king is worried about too, right?
Right.
You know, that moon tea.
Yeah, the Westeros Plan B.
It really is. And I'm just wondering, like, when are we going to meet a maester that's sort of like your cool professor?
The Walter White
of Westeros. I want to meet a maester that doesn't look like he's, you know, got two gouty feet.
Right, it's the price you pay.
I mean,
right?
I guess we had Sam at the end of the... But I'm just waiting for...
Yeah, but he strikes me as someone who would end up with, you know, some sort of a condition.
Right, yeah. I just... They can't all be like that, right? I guess if you're going to ascend to the heights and be the maester of the king, you're probably late-stage career maester, I would guess.
Yeah, I think maybe, like, there's, like, a reality show in Westeros we don't know about where it's just, like, you know, it's, like, hot maester or something like
rate,
that. It's,
rate my maester, hotness factors.
Yeah, exactly, everybody.
All right.
Got it bad. I'm hot for maester.
I love that video, by the way. Hot for maester. That was sort of, like, a big deal, 1985, hot for maester. All right.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
This is a storyline, a very short storyline, Daemon and Missaria. Daemon wakes up with a hangover in Missaria's King's Landing apartment. She tries to give him some sort of elixir, but he pours it out and insults her. She tells him he can pay for the room on his way out. So a couple things about this. Number one, my sense is that we've met our new Varys.
Mm.
She's called the White Worm. She's clearly managing the little bird that was sort of witnessing the whole thing.
Right.
And so she must have some kind of connection with Sir Otto. Then the question is, now that Sir Otto is sort of out of the picture, what kind of influence will she be able to wield?
Yeah, and what is Otto now?
Yeah, like how will he continue to exert influence? Because there's no way he's not going to exert influence, right?
Well, his daughter is queen. So there is an inevitable connection, right? I mean, it's like, it's one thing to remove him as the hand, but I mean, are they going to, you know, remove him from a, you know, a family perspective as well?
Well,
I mean,
it's almost like that's a pretty big deal. You've established now that he had, you know, because he has a Varys in King's Landing, presumably he goes back to Old Town and he, you know, sits in his castle or whatever, but he still has eyes and ears and he still has sort of some authority over the queen.
Yeah, which does present itself, like, to me, this is an exciting moment from a viewing perspective because, you know, I mean, everybody's got a certain agenda, but Otto has, there's a craftiness and a much bigger picture approach that we don't have. Like, that's what's the criticism of Damon as a quote villain is he's very live in the moment. He doesn't seem like he's got these grand plans, whereas Otto could be that.
That's right. You got a guy with actual machinations. So Masari is our new Varys, and so that's interesting. And then I was also going to say that you kind of see Damon with his ex-girlfriend. I mean, it's kind of a weird thing to have an ex-girlfriend in this world. Right. But it's sort of like, I'm getting the sense that she wasn't thrilled with what he said about her being pregnant, and she just leaves Dragonstone. Because now she's living in King's Landing, and she's connected in King's Landing. And it's interesting to me that, like, you almost see the people who are cast off by the tornado. You know, they're going to go live their lives afterwards. They had their time with Damon, and they had their fun. And they're not going to stay with him forever because that's not what happens with tornadoes. So I like that she's, you know, she's kind of landed on her feet. She's in King's Landing. She still kind of has a little affection for him. Otherwise, you know, why nurse him back to health? But she kind of knows, like, you're bad for all the women in your life, and I'm not going to be that for you. That's my sense of it anyway.
But as we've just been discussing, that there, you know, the connections potentially with Otto and any other kind of, like, maybe her role isn't, maybe there is an assignment attached to some of this as well.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, we'll have to see how she comes into the plot, because she's kind of been ancillary to this point. But you can kind of, like, if you have the job Varys had, you can absolutely be influential. And I always got the sense that kind of Varys, while a little bit slimy, kind of had the best interests of the realm in mind. I've got no idea what her motives are. What was her design? Did she love Damon, or did she want to get close to Damon because that was a proximity to power thing? Because she has aspirations of her own. It's totally veiled. I don't understand why she's doing what she's doing yet in the show.
Which is something to that's pretty remarkable. We've you know, this is one of the few episodes where we didn't travel a couple of years, but we, like, you know, things are unfolding, but there's still a lot to be discovered.
Okay, last storyline: Otto gets canned. Otto Hightower receives a message from the spy network. Apparently, someone named the White Worm has important information. The next morning, Otto informs the king that Damon and Rhaenyra were coupling in the bowels of a pleasure den. Viserys calls it gossip. The king and the princess discuss Otto. As they argue, Rhaenyra accuses Otto of being self-interested and demands that Otto be dismissed. Otto is summoned and canned. I like that Viserys was, you know, she's basically saying, look, Otto's got his own interests in mind. You can't trust him. And the king quips back, everyone I meet is self-interested. That means that everyone on the small council is self-interested. That's part of the job. Like, that's right. I love that he put it as blatantly as that. It made me really, like, I think that early on I thought this guy doesn't know what it's like to be king. I think he absolutely understands what it takes to be king. It's just that how could anyone be good at this? Right. I just think that the job is just, it's just fraught. And unless you're like a genius, how are you going to thrive? Anyway, I just love what he said about, like, it's the job of the king to realize that every single person at that table is self-interested and to be wise enough to kind of read through all of that spin to find the advice that you need.
Yeah, and it's rare self-awareness it feels like from Viserys. But but it's only seems like whenever, I mean, like the dynamic between Viserys and Rhaenyra seems to be like one of the more genuine back and forths, right?
Yeah.
Like so that's kind of it's a nice break, because it feels, even though we feel like we have a better understanding of maybe their motivation, so even if they're not being completely honest with each other, it still feels like we can track those conversations and understand where they're headed. And it does feel like there is, at the core, you know, I mean, she's going to keep certain things from him. I mean, his father, she's a teenager, and he's going to keep certain things from her because he's the king and the father, all those different things. But so you understand why, but it feels like there's at least an undercurrent of sincerity when they speak. Like, even with the Otto thing, right? I mean, she's right, but her motivations may not be to be right by the realm.
Well, she's absolutely right. She's got her own self-interest, right? But she realizes who Otto is.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, the king kind of is coming to the realization, but he almost tolerates it. I think he's kind of he's suspected, like, why did Allison come to my room the night my wife died? And he, right. I think he's been suspicious for a long time. And then, of course, Otto.
But he needs him, right? I mean, Otto is a better. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why he's at the hand, right? And Viserys, unlike some other kings that we've seen in these shows, is that, like, he gets it, like, sure. The need for a council, right?
Well, that's
part of
the thing.
Because he just doesn't want to think about it.
That's the thing. You want, let's say, you want a smart hand of the king, right? So how often will you? So let's say you just go out and find the smartest, most politically savvy guy to be hand of the king. What are the chances that person's not also going to be a schemer?
Right.
You know, it's like, that's kind of it. If you're good at the political machinations, you're probably also going to be a schemer.
Right.
So I thought it was
interesting. It'd be weird if you weren't.
It'd be weird if it wasn't, right? So then the question is, who's next? And you know, I think that if it was me, I would probably promote, you know, Lord Strong.
That's my thought.
And it's interesting because he does present as someone who's wise and politically savvy. And if he is a schemer, he's kind of held his cards close.
Right.
Right. You don't have that sense of him yet.
Yeah. Whereas Otto, like, maybe it may have been a long time coming, but he's definitely, like, now it's like he's pulling the, you know, all the levers.
Uh-huh.
Or trying to.
I do like that Otto goes out with a little dignity. I feel like he knows, like, well, I'm still going to be playing the game, even if I'm not in this room. I'm a bit surprised. Looks like I'm not going to be hand of the king anymore. I'm not going to, like, you know, kick the dirt on my way out, because this is not over, and it very well could be that I need to have a relationship with this king going forward.
Well, and it could very well be that if it looks like something's unravel and you need to have some stability, maybe you bring Otto back into the fold, and maybe it's because of things that Otto has done to create instability. But if he's too clever to go out like that, right? I mean, he strikes me as this was a potential, you know, this fallout was, you know, not necessarily inevitable, but it was probably part of the plan. Like, this could go this way, and if that's the case, then I do this. That, again, different than Damon. Like, this happened. Yeah, now. Exactly. Well, all right. Like even his haircut, I don't even know that he was like, he's probably like, gosh, why did I cut off all my hair? It's just so impetuous.
Where do you go for a haircut in Westeros? like someone's got to be doing this stuff, right?
Yeah, one guy was probably like as he was walking by feeling pretty good about himself, he had his crown on, and someone's like, I didn't know Nelson got back together. And then he's like, that's it, I'm cutting my hair.
Okay, Cheekspeak. I'm going to let you judge this one. Because you took the over. You took 5 and took the over, and I took the under.
Yeah, they definitely went under because of the speak.
Yeah, it's a little crazy thinking like this, the episode, you know, this was sort of the sex carnival episode, right?
Yeah, I think the best I could come up with was 2.
Yeah, I came up with 3.
I had 2 side cheeks.
I think it's at one point I see a tiny crack of Sir Criston's.
Okay.
So that would give us 2, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it was sort of like I was, again, kudos to Claire Kilner to put together an episode that was like all about sex, and just to thwart our cheek speak element of this podcast.
Yeah, so I mean, like, we were right in the sense that we were due, but we were wrong in the sense of how it was executed.
Clearly, Claire is a listener to Double Dragon, and she thought it would be fun to mess with us.
Well, I think this is where we have to have, we have to really call a rat out on the table here. I mean, if she's listening and she's like, oh, crap, you know, I bet the under, and she quick runs into the editing room. A few blurs, a few close-ups, get rid of this scene. Next thing you know, she's cashing in.
So I'm going to say that the under one on this one.
Yes, the under one.
You noticed 2. I noticed, I think I counted 3. So amazing. Amazing that this episode, we were on the under for the cheek speak. Okay, Steve, was this a Dorne, a Dany, or a Dinklage rated episode?
This is a hard one for me, but I think I'm going to go a Dinklage -2.
That's interesting. I'm going to go a properly Dinklage on this.
Properly Dinklage, okay. Yeah. I think I'm just reluctant, you know? I mean...
Well, once you go Dinklage, it's sort of like now you're measuring everything against an episode, right?
Right. So I was tempted to go... in the properly Dinklage realm. I think it was a really rich episode. I think it was, like you said, I think it was wonderfully directed. There were a lot of, there was a lot of really good parallels. There was a lot of interesting things that unfolded. It's dramatic. It just, I walked in and go, that was very good. I knew I was in more Dinklage range, but I wasn't. It still wasn't. Didn't have that like oh, ho, ho, ho. Like to me that's the Dinklage, like the oh, ho, ho,
yeah,
noise.
Sure.
I have to make that noise.
Yeah. So if you need a little refresher here, so Dinklage is a great episode, a Dany is a good episode, and a Dorne is an underwhelming episode. I'm gonna say it's properly Dinklage. I felt like, you know, put myself in Viserys' shoes. He's clearly misunderstanding the situation. Would I act any differently based on the information that he has? Would I act any differently as king? I don't know. Like, I might, but I can't. I mean, I can totally understand why he's acting the way he's acting. And then, of course, you look at sort of Rhaenyra. You can't really fault her for doing what she's doing. You know, she's going to sort of realize later in life, like, oh, that was really reckless. I absolutely shouldn't have done that. But as a teenager, it's not like my opinion of her lessens because of some of the actions that she's taken. From Allison's point of view, she's playing by all the rules. I did everything. You asked me to be miserable. I'm going to be miserable. You know, I can totally understand why she's resentful of her friend. You know, Damon's like this wild card, but I can't take my eyes off him. So I think everyone in this episode, I understand why you act in the world the way that you do. And then it's the alchemy of problems that's created when all of these characters bump against each other. To me, that is great storytelling. And so I'm going to say a properly Dinklage.
Right on.
Finally, Steve, I wanted to read a review on Apple iTunes, which we love to get from listeners. This was our first 2-star review.
Ooh.
It's called Double Bummer.
Nice.
And it's written by Hi. Right, that's what this person calls themselves. I really loved the Electric Boogaloo rereads from Anthony's other podcast. I absolutely enjoy the different viewpoints and inside information from the academia guests. Why I won't be listening to Double Dragon anymore is because the hosts seem to only find the negatives in everything. It seems to me that they are looking for reasons not to like the show. Everyone has their own opinion, and that is fine, but the mention of in every episode that it's not funny enough for them because there isn't a Tyrion-like character is getting very stale. It's a fairly it's a family drama fantasy, not a family comedy fantasy. I would love to see more optimism from the hosts. And in all honesty, if I keep listening, it will only be skipping to the part where the professors are giving more inside information into medieval life. So that was from Hai, and I think that maybe she's got a kernel of truth, but I can't help feel like I'm being judged unfairly.
We've given every episode a positive review for one thing.
Well, I did give one a Dorn. Yeah, I think I gave the last one a Dorn because I didn't, but I really, it was only that one storyline that it didn't work for me. It was the crab feeder storyline that didn't work for me in the end. I actually really like this show. I look forward to this show. So I think maybe I should make that clear. In fact, I gave this last episode a very high rating.
I mean, I think if the concern is that we appear to be focused on those moments that could use a little levity or humor and we mention it, in the same way, I would say that your critique of the podcast is really focusing on one element of the podcast.
I don't feel like it would serve the podcast well if we started shying away from saying the things that didn't work for us.
Right.
I think that in order to be honest dealers, we're going to have to sort of call something out when we think, yeah, that didn't work. Or, you know, this episode needed a little bit more warmth or a little bit more levity.
Yeah, we like the show. I mean, there's a lot, like, I'm rewatching Breaking Bad, and this show, I think is one of my favorite shows of all time. And there are moments now where I'm looking at it with a little bit more of a critical eye, and I'm like, maybe that scene wasn't great, or maybe that was a little melodramatic, but it doesn't take away from my enjoyment of it. In fact, if anything, it's actually heightening my appreciation for it because I'm looking at all of it and how it gets put together. And I mean, again, this is a show that we have, I think, spoken pretty fondly of, while also looking at it not just as a story, but how it's constructed and how it fits into the Game of Thrones universe. And that universe includes, if I may invoke Viserys, perception. It matters. And the perception of Game of Thrones going into House of Dragon, we've talked about, is very mixed. And like you said, it's got the burden of being following a great show and the burden of following one of the most disappointing moments in television history. Those are two heavy burdens to balance at the same exact time. And that's just a reality of the viewing experience. So, you know, we're looking at this. I mean, the very fact that our rating system brings
in. Yeah, we're always comparing. Every single episode we're comparing, right?
Right.
Okay, so I'm going to just say, in defense of Hai, again, it's a perception issue. So she's perceived our particular podcast in this way. So in this way, perception kind of supersedes truth. And I think that's what reviews do a lot of the time. In addition to that, I think if I was going to be a little bit self-reflective, why is Dinklage my high mark, right? Why is the comedy relief of the first show the thing that I've set up as the standard for this show?
Right, well, that's fair.
And it's probably, I don't know, going into this, I think we came up with our rating system before we had watched a single episode of House of the Dragon. And so it's a flawed rating system, and I'm happy with it. I'm happy to keep it the way that it is. And just note that our rating system means nothing.
Right.
I
would say that, while Dinklage did provide much of the comic relief, there was other comic relief besides Dinklage. And some of the episodes that I think of where Dinklage, where I would put him on that high level, I'm thinking of, in the courtroom, I'm thinking of him in the cell having conversations with his brother. And those moments weren't particularly funny. They just had.
Oh, no, he did. He was like the range on Dinklage and the complicated elements of that character go far beyond comic relief. And I think that is what a good Dinklage episode would bring.
It could give you all of that, and none of it was none of it was diluting the other. In fact, it was all enhancing each other. So that's when I look at the high water mark of a Dinklage. I look at is this, and that's why I think this episode that we just reviewed is in that range, because there was magnificent melodrama, really interesting political machinations that were going on, character development that just further complicated relationships. All of that was happening.
Yeah, and all the actors are pulling this off. So,
right.
So, I hope you stick with us. But I totally understand if you need to go elsewhere. That's fine, too. All right, Steve. Predictions. Oh, we didn't do Cheek Speak predictions for the next episode.
Oh, that's right. Well, in that scene, I feel like I'm going to get burned, but I'm gonna set... at this point, I think you have to start looking at the data. And I think I'm going to set the line at 2.5.
So 2.5. So you're looking at 2 full moons and a side cheek. And and these have to be characters who have some dialogue in the episode, right?
Yeah.
And so 2.5. If I think it's exactly 2.5, do I go over or under?
Well, yeah, it's a push.
It's a push. All right, I'm going to go for the push.
Okay. So you think it's going to go 2.5?
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. I'm going to go over.
Oh,
I'm just going to stick with the over.
You're just going to continue to do it.
Because I continue.
You're right.
I continue to set this line.
No pun intended.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
All right, so book at baldmove.com if you have a question. This is a question from Thomas. This is an interesting question. Were there any people in the pre-modern period that were sex positive? Or were they more puritanical? Was sex mostly a thing done for progeny? Was it mostly a thing between married couples? I get the sense that ancient Romans were sometimes free thinkers. Did things change all that much between periods?
So first of all, like, the use of the word puritanical is interesting here, because Puritanism is, of course, a later religious sect. It's much, much later. It's not medieval at all.
Right.
Puritanism develops in the 16th century as a reaction against Catholicism. Puritans wore black and white. They abstained from drinking. They were notorious for hating the theater during Shakespeare's lifetime. So while they are very much not medieval, they are early modern. They have an incredible influence on the way that modern Western ideas and culture have developed, particularly right. in the United States, but also in the United Kingdom.
My sense is that Thomas is thinking more in the colloquial sense of the term.
Sure. But that is kind of, but it's interesting because that is a, it's, Puritanism was a reaction against Catholicism, and it was very, and it was a specifically a reaction against late medieval Catholicism.
Okay.
And late medieval Catholicism was, it's like, there was a lot going on there, and some of it was more questionable than others. But in a more general sense, just like in modern times, pre-modern ideas of sex and sexuality existed on a spectrum. They wouldn't use words, the same words that we use today. They wouldn't use the same terminology that we use today, homosexual, transgender, anything like that, to describe themselves. But the ideas and the identities did exist. And we can absolutely see them in primary sources if we know what we're looking for. Particularly, it's interesting, particularly if you look at saints' lives. That is where a lot of these ideas tend to crop up, because the way that they ended up getting
explained. You said saints?
Saints' lives, yes.
Yeah.
Medieval saints' lives are an absolute treasure trove for looking at ideas about medieval sexuality and ideas about, particularly ideas about medieval gender, because saints occupied a very different space. They occupied a very different physical space from normal people. They were viewed as other. They were viewed as blessed, isolated. Like they were just put into a very
They were set apart.
Yeah, right. They were set apart. And many of those saints had very interesting, very almost modern ideas about their own identities. And it's really interesting. There's some wonderful work that's been done on this. I recommend the work of G.W. Bachowski. I can give you the exact, I can give you a list just so I don't mess up spellings and things like that. But
sure,
there are a bunch of books on this topic and a bunch of articles on this topic. And it is there's an incredible amount of information. But it is important to remember that that medieval Europe did not exist in a vacuum, and we can also see the influence of Islamic ideas, especially in southern regions. And Islam, particularly, I'm talking about medieval Islam here. Medieval Islam was actually a very sex-positive religion. And so if you look at areas like Sicily, southern Italy, Byzantium, Iberia, even southern France, a lot of these ideas kind of permeate over these borders, because there was so much cultural exchange happening. There was trade going on. People were sharing right. ideas about poetry. They were sharing ideas about the classics. Like, the way that classical literature, what we think of as classical literature, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, the way that all of those writings made it into Europe at the time was through the caliphate. It was through trade with the Middle East. So all of these ideas are kind of percolating in Europe. And so I wouldn't go so far as to say that medieval people were sex positive. Sex was part of life. It was very much a part of people's lives. And it was very much a part of people's everyday lives, because when you think about a medieval household, you don't get much privacy. You've got everyone living in a single room. Sure.
Yeah, right.
So if, like, whoever you were sharing a house with, like, everybody knew what was going
on. Yeah, these kids everyone are coming from somewhere, and there's usually other people in the house, right?
Yep. It was rare to have your own bed, let alone your own bedroom. Everyone was all up in everybody else's business.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you've read, for instance, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, there are plenty of raunchy scenes and raunchy subplots. They're all in there for comedic purposes. And yeah, some of them are meant like, okay, you know, you really shouldn't be doing this, but also it's all just comedy. Even if some of it is comedy, that some of it is not something that we would find funny today, it was considered comic at the time. So for instance, the character of the wife of Bath, she has married 5 separate times. She boasts about how great she is in bed. And at one point it is indicated that that one of her husbands might've died in bed with her. But we don't actually get the sense that we're meant to disapprove of her at all. Like, this is just a fun woman who happened to be married 5 separate times and who is very might good at kill, sex. And,
who's so good at sex that she might kill you with it.
Yep, exactly. and at one point, late in the Wife of Bath's prologue, she's like, yeah, I've had 5 husbands, but I'm on the lookout for number 6. Yeah, like this is a woman we're clearly not meant to disapprove of her. She's clearly meant to just be a lot of fun. Okay. But on the other hand, you also have something like The Romance of the Rose, which one of my favorite professors described The Romance of the Rose as 20,000 lines of poetry about a man trying to have sex with a plant. And I can't disagree.
That's great. That's great. Well, it's a great question, Thomas, and I had no idea how Kavita was going to answer, but it's just really great to hear this. I think you could get the sense from a Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon show that everyone's having sex with everyone all of the time. But I think that there's probably danger in the other extreme too, right?
Yes.
You know, that everyone's basically a prude before the 1960s. Not exactly true either.
No, like, and one of the things that I'm constantly hammering on in everything that I publish, and also sort of just anytime people ask me about received ideas about medieval Europe, one of the things I always have to remind everyone is keep in mind that a lot of the histories that we are reading today do not come from the medieval period. They come from the 19th century.
Right.
And they come from Victorian England. And Victorian England had mad hang-ups about sex. And they take those hang-ups and they project them.
And what period are, what are the dates we're talking about with Victorian England?
Victorian England is like 1847 to 1901, I believe, is the exact reign of Queen Victoria. But I think it was 1847 to 1901. I'm a little unclear on the early section, but I know
it gives us an idea. It gives us a general idea, right? So,
So general idea, but you're talking about the bulk of the 19th century. You're talking about the industrial, like the real rise of the Industrial Revolution, the height of the British Empire. And it's worth keeping in mind that there were a lot of political reasons to frame the Middle Ages the way that they did.
Thank you.
Thank you.